It seems like every news story that comes out about the environment is gloom and doom, about how mankind is destroying the planet and climate change is wreaking havoc on places around the world.
Even with reduced human activity, the past year or so has been no exception. Not to be a Debbie Downer, but Australian bushfires destroyed upwards of 42 million acres and either harmed or killed 3 billion animals at the beginning of 2020. The world's largest iceberg is on course to strike South George Island, endangering its populations of penguins, whales, and seals. Tens of thousands of fires have been set to clear huge swaths of the Brazilian rainforest. And according to Conservation International, the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere reached its highest level in recorded history this past May.
But there were also some positives. Hundreds of new species are discovered every year. One of my favorite stories of 2020 was the rediscovery of the tiny elephant shrew in Djibouti 50 years after it was thought to have disappeared.
So cool. And another fun discovery, research from the IMF uncovered yet another reason to protect whales, finding that each one sequesters an average of 33 tons of carbon dioxide, which is equivalent to 1,000 trees over their lifetime.
Healing is possible, and as the world opens back up and travelers decide where to spend their time and tourism dollars, we wanted to highlight two particular places where humans have rehabilitated the environment and achieved incredibly positive results.
I'm Catherine Romine, and as always, I'm here with my co-host, Eric Rosen. This is Conscious Traveler, our podcast celebrating sustainability, conservation, culture, and community around the world. By sharing our stories and those of fascinating experts, we aim to help you make your next adventure more meaningful and memorable. I traveled to Akagera National Park in Rwanda in 2019 and was instantly struck by its natural beauty and myriad wildlife. During my stay at Wilderness Safari's Magashi Camp, where the beds were wrapped in rose-pink mosquito netting and grunting hippos were my alarm clock, we went on game drives and even boat trips on Lake Rwanya-Kazinga, which felt like its own beautiful little world. In stark contrast to the gorillas of Volcanoes National Park, I saw plenty of leopards and rhino, lions and buffalo, elephants and crocodiles.
But what you experienced was almost lost forever. After the Rwandan genocide, as people returned to the country, Akagera's wildlife was hunted almost to extinction. That changed in 2010, though, thanks to a partnership with African Parks that would eventually reintroduce endemic species, including black rhinos and lions.
Even more impressive is the fact that the park is almost totally sustained by tourism now. To learn more about how Rwanda and African Parks pulled off this near-miraculous turnaround, we called Jean-Paul Karinganer, Akagera's Assistant Tourism and Marketing Manager. So Jean-Paul, I know you've been working at Akagera National Park since 2016. I'm sure what you were seeing as a child was quite different from the reality of what Akagera is today, since back in the 90s and 2000s, it was not at all in the same state as currently, which is what we want to talk about, of course. So how have you seen the sort of evolution of this park?
Well, I would say that Akagera has come really far. From the genocide against the Tutsis in 1994, the whole country was really affected by the tragedy. And because of the genocide, the people had to flee the country and go outside. But after the genocide was stopped by the current government, the people returned and they settled outside the park. And many of them were cattle keepers and farmers. So they were in constant conflict with the park. I mean, human-wildlife conflicts, because the cattle keepers had their cows, other livestock around the park. They were grazing inside the park, and there were a lot of predators, including lions, leopards, hyenas, who will find it easier to prey on the cow. So they kill the cows, and then the people in exchange, they were losing. They took revenge, they killed the lions, and they managed to finish 300 lions. So the story goes like that, and the government was busy with other things. I mean, rebuilding the country after losing 1 million people, infrastructures, the healthcare, education, things like that. So I think conservation was not on top of other priorities to do during that time. And it was until 2010 when the government of Rwanda called African Parks to come and help to manage Akagera National Park. African Parks, they have the expertise in managing conservation areas like this. They have the expertise in the whole Africa, and like in Malawi, where they rebuilt one park which was completely out of animals, like which is called Machete. And then, of course, Rwanda was lucky that they accepted, and then they came in Akagera, and it was a game changer.
If I can ask, just to give people an idea of the size of the problem, could you give us a snapshot maybe of
How many animals were living in Akagera before the 90s, and then how many were there by 2010 when Rwanda reached out to African parks?
I have to mention a few species like lions. There were about 300 lions in the park, and the size of the park was 2,500 square kilometers. It was quite huge compared to the current size. Mm. So there was a lot of lions. Elephant number was really small. There was some rhinos in the park. The last rhino was seen in 2007, but there was rhinos introduced in Akagera in 1957. And those rhinos reproduced up to about 90 individuals. And they were all poached due to this genocide against the Tutsis. So that genocide, people going in the revolution, people wanting power, chasing other people away, and there was no one really hungry to keep the wildlife intact. Everyone was busy with taking the power, but there was no one concentrated with, you know, conservation or keeping wildlife safe. So people were allowed to come in the park, kill animals however they want.
I think there was a survey when African parks came in, done of all the mammals, and you mentioned there were less than 5,000 big mammals. And then last year's census showed a lot of exciting growth, right?
Indeed, yeah. So last year shown a growth in really big mammals. We counted about 13,500 animals in total, including the newly introduced lions and the newly introduced black rhinos in the park.
Jean-Paul, when African parks came in and the Rwandese government reached out for their help, what were the major issues that you had to deal with in the park and reestablishing it? I imagine poaching was one of them that you had to contend with in order to get those animal numbers back up to where they are and create a healthy system for those animals to live in.
Thanks, Eric. I would say poaching was the first thing, you know, the park was facing back in 2010 when African parks and government of Rwanda had an agreement. But also the human wildlife conflicts were a major issue because the people were killing animals because they were thinking they're protecting themselves, but they were killing animals which were innocent. So the major issue, if I repeat, was the poaching, people killing animals for bushmeat. We are lucky that people don't have firearms in our region, but people were killing animals using the local weapons like spears, machete. The main problem in the park was that they were putting snares, the traps everywhere in the park, and a trap is potentially a dead animal because it doesn't discriminate. It can catch any type of animal. If a poacher comes in mind to kill maybe an antelope, it could end up trapping an elephant or a lion or a rhino also. And we are facing the consequences in the time because we have some elephants with swelling legs, with half trunks. And so that was one of the major issues. And the second issue, as I said, was human wildlife conflicts. The park was not fenced. There was a lot of human encroachment to the park. People were having their businesses around the park, and buffaloes and hippos and elephants found it easier to raid crops for the people surrounding the park. And the people were snaring them, killing them, and the lions were preying on their cattle. They had to poison them, and they managed to finish 300 lions. And I would say that our rhinos were poached for the ivory.
I think you had also said to us that in 2013, the Park Service recovered 2,000 snares just in the park, just in that 1 year alone. So that's potentially 2,000 or more dead animals.
Yes. So 2013 was a peak year. I would say that when African parks arrived in Akagera, they had to first tackle the poaching issue. The first thing they started with is to train new personnel and hire new rangers and build an operations room, which will help to communicate with the rangers on the field, reporting, mapping the covered areas in patrols. So in 2013, I would say that's when it was like our peak year. About 420 people were arrested. Unfortunately, 200 evaded the arrest. A lot of things were confiscated, like bushmeat. 1 ton of bushmeat, 1 ton of fish were confiscated from the poachers. People not only poach for meat, but they can also poach for timber. There was a popular tree species called kabaruka in our local language. It's in English, East Africa sandalwood. You can make essential oils from that tree. So people were poaching on it, and it was about to be extinct in the park. And we were lucky the government of Rwanda constructed a kind of fence surrounding the park on the western boundary of the park to tackle the human wildlife conflicts. Because when you secure the park inside, the next step is to work with the community for them to understand why do you have a park around you and what value do you find it in.
Right. A lot of people who are killing these animals were doing so out of fear that, you know, maybe they're hurting their animals, taking their crops, they're afraid of them, which is understandable because if you don't understand something, you're afraid of it. But I know education and bringing the community into this was a really vital part of the success of it, right?
Yeah, indeed. Bringing the community into the picture of conservation was really key and very critical because I would say now the community really understand the park. They love the park because we give them tangible benefits of having the park around them. And those people were killing buffaloes and the other animals. The park helped them to have like a butchery where they sell domestic animal meat rather than bush meat, which means they moved from poaching. A lot of people who were poachers, they were put in cooperatives where they were helped to develop themselves by doing local project that could benefit them rather than coming to the park poaching. So the park tried the best to find alternatives to the community surrounding the park. So they developed themselves without thinking of poaching.
I think, you know, you bring up a point that's important in all of conservation. When we think about conservation, I think we tend to focus on what's going on with the animals, let's get as many in there as possible. But you can't really have any conservation or successful conservation if you're not taking care of those communities that are around and in the park and working in the parks. I think you said that you were working to make the park 100% sustainable on tourism dollars, which is perhaps, you know, not happening right now. But last year, you made it to about 90% sustainable on tourism dollars. And part of that is making sure that money also goes to the communities around the park so that they recognize exactly its importance. And I was wondering what some of the specific projects you do are, some of the educational projects, how else you reach out to those communities to help support them through the activities at Akagera.
Thanks. That's a very interesting question. We work with the community really very, very closely. We source almost everything in the community. Our lodges, they buy eggs, vegetables, all the foods, really, they purchase in the local communities. And that means all the money coming from the lodge, they go back to the community. That's one. And we have what we call educational program, which is based on environmental education. We bring in here children from primary and secondary school to learn about environment, and they are taught how to coexist with wildlife, and when I see a baboon raiding my crops, what do I do? Do I throw stones at him? Do I poison him? Or do I try to coexist with it? And how do you coexist with it? We have taught the schools around, there are environmental clubs in the schools, and we've shown them how some areas in East Africa where they were like baboons, which were crop raiding, and they had to plant the trees which the baboons like to divert the intention of their crops. Also, the people who live in areas where there are lions, they have to build bomas with thorns so that the lions don't approach. So that's one way of coexisting with animals in another region, which we've shown them that this is possible. We can coexist with animals, and animals are innocent. They live, they want food, they want to reproduce, and they want security. So they don't want to hurt you, but sometimes they can hurt you, but they are protecting themselves. So we're trying to teach the children. We show them the development that Akagera has had in the past years, and we're trying to develop the people around. We have very many cooperatives that Akagera National Park helps. For example, the beekeeping cooperative. We try to apply grants for them to help them produce honey in a more professional way. We were lucky to receive a grant from the United States ambassador of around $7,000 to buy materials for honey processing. And then now it's a very big cooperative. Last year, they produced about 9 tons of honey. They produce it, they package it, and then they can sell all over the country. And then we also buy for them to sell in our courier shop at the park reception. We also have fisheries. That's one of the main activities, actually. We have 10 lakes in the park, and all the lakes, they contain fish. Probably we try to fish them in a more conservation way by having the right nets for fishing in one area and moving for reproduction. Now, the cooperative that operates fishing is from the community. Obviously, we have Gila staff overseeing them, how they, if they follow the protocols, and it's going well. We have probably solved the malnutrition in the region, because a kilo of fish in Kigali, it costs about 3,000 or 3,500. But in the community, the fish fished in the park, they cost about 1,500. And then the people can buy fish, they can enrich themselves with the fish sold in the community, and then it's going well.
That's amazing. And I don't know if everyone knows this, but Rwanda is one of the most densely populated countries in the world. And you had said in the 9 sectors around the park, there are about 400,000 people living. So to be able to have had such a great impact on something like malnutrition and also just people's livelihoods and economic statuses is pretty amazing. So I'm sure they're seeing the value of it and feel proud of it too. And we love talking about the animals. You had mentioned before the lions have been brought in from South Africa and now have been doing really well. They're having babies, they're growing up, having more babies. And rhinos were more recently brought in from zoos, right? In the UK and Denmark and the Czech Republic.
Yeah.
And so how are they doing? And are the people in the surrounding areas excited to see these animals come back? Do they feel like a sort of personal connection or pride about that?
Yeah, I'm really not patronizing on this one, but I have to say that I experienced one of the best events in 2019 when we organized a race called the Rhino Velo Race. It's a cycling race where we invite people to participate. They bring their local bicycles. They race for the rhinos. So we have about 200 participants. So, of course, you have to bring someone like that everyone knows, I would say a star. We brought someone singing in Rwanda, and then people after the race, he sang for them, and there was a lot of dancing girls around, and then it was a very good event. And then in the middle of that, in the middle of the fun, the park manager and the government representative took the speech and say, we are having fun, we are enjoying our lives, but I have to say that this is for the rhinos. We have to protect them, we have to understand them, and you would be amazed by the poems of the people in the community about rhinos and things like that. They are happy to have them back. And it's really good that Akagera came really far from the people poaching to now the people protecting the wildlife. It's really a touching story, and I really like it myself and I enjoy it. So it's really good that people understand. Just for other information, we've had 5 rhinos from European zoos in 2019, but we also have 18 rhinos from South Africa in 2017. So it's a total of 23 introduced black rhinos, and we've had babies, we've had losses, but we are lucky that the losses were not for poaching, they were natural losses. So we have a healthy number of rhinos, which we are trying to sustain. We have a dedicated monitoring team that follows them on a daily basis, and they have to report on the state of each rhino on a daily basis.
What you had said is that, you know, these rhinos that had come from the zoos had been born and bred in captivity, hadn't been wild at all. So there must have been some concerns about how they would adapt to the park, but that they've been thriving, sort of like the lions and leopards have. I think you mentioned that the lion population has just basically been exploding. It's still supported by the rest of the ecosystem, but that has been a tremendous success story too, as well as other predators like hyenas and jackals and stuff like that. So how are the animals doing these days?
So I'd say Akagera is really balanced ecosystem at the moment. It was unbalanced before 2015 because the lions have had a very big impact on the ecosystem. Currently, on average, I would say that they kill about 4,000 prey a year. It's a huge number, but the park has a lot of antelopes and a lot of buffaloes in the park. So it's really balanced, I would say. On the other side of hyenas, and we've seen more and more, we have had sightings of hyenas and sightings of vultures, which almost disappeared in Rwanda when there were no lions. But when the lions came back, the vultures also returned. And it's a balanced ecosystem. The animals are thriving. Of course, you know, it's a big number, 4,000, but also you can imagine how many antelopes we have in the yard. It's more than that.
If you've been on safari, you know antelope are usually in plentiful numbers.
Yeah, indeed. So having the lions solved the issue, and the hyenas are now active. The leopards also we have a healthy numbers. We're trying to identify different leopards. We have so far 55 identified in the individuals who were seen through camera traps and analysis of their spot patterns. So at the moment, in the north region of the park and the south region of the park, we can count about 55 leopards. But in the middle of the park, we're still installing camera traps to know how many exactly we have in the park.
Leopards are my favorite, and it was actually when I visited Akagera last year, one of the first animals I was able to see was a leopard who was just sitting by the road as we drove into the park, and it was such an amazing welcome because in my other experience of going on safaris, usually leopards are so hard to find. And, you know, I have to emphasize how wonderfully surprised I was at just the proliferation of wildlife and, again, the diversity of it here, because most people think of Rwanda as a destination for gorilla trekking. And of course, while it's an incredible place for that, I think the success of Akagera is that it's now coming onto the global scene in a way to where people are understanding that you can go to Rwanda and have a really, really well-rounded wildlife experience, seeing the big five, as well as gorillas, chimpanzees, great apes. You know, I think the opening of Magashi Camp last year from Wilderness Safaris also really contributed to that, I believe, because it's a known, wonderful conservation company, and that camp is just beautiful. And I know you've mentioned as well that there are plans in the future to bring potentially a couple other camps into the park that I think would also probably further that success and also be very sustainable and incorporating the local community and benefiting them through revenue sharing, correct?
Correct. So speaking of Magashi, it's a really nice lodge and really a five-star eco-lodge that supports conservation. They have the expertise in managing high-end areas, and Magashi is one of them. And they have another lodge in the north of Rwanda, in the close to the volcanoes, called Bisati. So they brought their contribution and they support some of the community initiatives in the north of the park. So it's a great addition to Akagera National Park. The two lodges that we have Ruzizi Tented Lodge, is also like Magashi, but more of a three-star. And then we have Akagera Game Lodge also in the south. It's a government-owned lodge, but also managed by a private company. So they're all contributing to the conservation of the park. And Ruzizi is owned 100% of the profit goes to the park, but Magashi and Akagera Game Lodge, they pay what we call a concession, and they contribute to the conservation in that way. And they sell Akagera and to the world, of course. And people can know that Akagera, they have some high-end lodges. And the two additional that we plan to include, they will be also high-end. And we hope they will be very nice and more publicity and more traffic to Akagera.
Sure. Well, speaking of which, you know, as we mentioned, we touched upon it earlier, the goal is for Akagera to be 100% self-sustaining through tourism. And obviously, COVID has changed a lot in the world, and including the fact that very few tourists could actually go to Rwanda this year, and we're not even sure about 2021 yet. How has that changed your plans and given you perhaps some new ideas about how the park can keep growing and keep improving while still supporting the local communities when tourism dollars might not be there for a while?
We were lucky to have African Parks. Many of the institutions in Rwanda have either stopped paying their employees or give them a pay cut. But us in Akagera and other African Parks project, we were very, very lucky to still be employed, paid 100%, our insurance is paid. I would say that's very good. So COVID-19 has hit the tourism really hard, and say that we budgeted for about 50,000 visitors at the beginning of the year, but we are sitting now at 16,000 visitors. We budgeted for around $3 million from tourism income, but I don't think we reached the half of it. But when COVID came, we have to revise our budget and what are the projects that can wait for the next year. Projects like we have football tournaments that we go in the community. We had to stop that because we're not allowed to gather people together. So all of that budget were decreased due to coronavirus. But when tourism recovers, Akagera is on the best track to go back to normal.
That's really nice to hear. And I'm sure at least during this time, you said that with rapid COVID tests, domestic tourism is up a bit. So at least it's a wonderful opportunity for local Rwandans to come to the park and be able to enjoy these amazing natural resources that you all have there and the wildlife. And again, sort of spreading the word and encouraging people to really have a personal connection to that, to keep it alive and keep it thriving.
Yeah, indeed. I have to commend the efforts of the government to contain the virus. It's really, I would say, amazing that we can have people back. And especially the people in the local community who have to enjoy the tourism, who have to enjoy the natural areas that we have in Rwanda. So the people in Rwanda, they don't travel a lot, I would say. But in the past 2 years, shown that kind of myth is changing, because 50% of visitors, actually, they are Rwandans.
That's incredible. Well, hopefully that progress, as you mentioned, will continue and people will be able to visit Rwanda again in greater numbers, because Akagera Park is certainly one of the places that is worth spending some time. Catherine's stories has made me very jealous that she's been there
attest.
And I haven't yet. So I'll look forward to visiting you. Thank you so much for your time, Jean-Paul.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me talking about my country, my park. It's really amazing. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I love it there. So we appreciate it.
Thank you.
From the beauty of Central Africa, we turn to the sea and talk to Peter Gash, the self-styled caretaker of Lady Elliot Island off the coast of Queensland in Australia.
For decades during the 19th century, Lady Elliot Island was strip mined for the guano produced by its bird population, which settlers used for fertilizer. By the 1970s, the island was barely more than a speck of barren rock at the southern end of the Great Barrier Reef.
But thanks to the efforts over decades of Peter and others, the island has been replanted with indigenous trees, the birds have returned, and as the ecosystem has begun to reconstitute itself, the surrounding reefs have been revived, and it's now one of the best spots in the world for diving with manta rays.
We called Peter in Australia to hear the story firsthand of this astonishing metamorphosis, and what is possible when conservation-minded folks channel tourism for good.
So Peter, tell us about when you first visited Lady Elliot Island. Where were you in your life? What was it like back then?
Yeah, thank you, Catherine. Well, my first visit was a long time ago. It was actually 40 years ago last week. And I went out there as a young
happy
single person.
Yeah, happy anniversary.
Yeah, thank you. It seems a long time, but it also seems like yesterday because it's such a wonderful place. It just keeps growing in my heart. But I went out there with a young lady and there was a couple of boatloads of friends that we went out there, and it was New Year's Eve in 1980. And I went snorkeling there, and I'd seen some other parts of the reef, but I'd never seen anything like that. It was just stunningly beautiful. We went ashore. We saw this island that was clearly had been devastated. We didn't understand it. I was only a young fellow at the time. And we then went on over to Lady Musgrave Island, the next island across, and saw the beautiful reef again and the beautiful forest that hadn't been devastated. So that was my first encounter. And I started to question why. Why is that place looking like that? The other places looking like that? And it started to seep into my heart. That was our first ever visit.
So it was clear to you from the start, like Lady Elliot Island, as you've described it in the past, was just basically a patch of rock. Like there were just a few trees on the island left at that point, and the reef around it had died. From that point, how did you get involved? And what were some of the things that you decided you needed to undertake in order to start rehabilitating the island?
Yeah, so Eric, you're right. What had happened was it had been strip mined in the 1860s for guano, which in another language is bird poo. And so it was used for fertilizer. And believe it or not, some of it was used for gunpowder in the US Civil War, mm-hmm. which is in the 1860s.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
Yeah. So they mined it. And of course, by mining it, they took it away with shovels and wheelbarrows. They took all the vegetation off. So what was once a beautiful, lush, tropical island paradise became a windswept barren rock. And in fact, that was its nickname. And so, yeah, once that island was stripped, it was pretty much doomed to fail. The question is, when was that going to happen? And the reef around the outside, because it had lost the circular dynamic of what goes on, it didn't die off completely, but the reef suffered and it wasn't in as good a condition as it would have been prior. But reefs are very resilient and it took a while to taper off. So by the time we got there, there'd been a lighthouse had been built. There was lighthouse keepers living there using the old European, old English thinking. They'd brought some of the old English vegetation to try and put under this windswept barren rock and I guess try and make it feel like home. And you're never going to make a coral cay.
Doesn't feel like the Cornish countryside, you're saying?
Absolutely not. You're just never going to do it. And,
right.
and so it was never going to make its grade. And so after that first visit, I went away. I was still doing other things in my life. I was actually a professional motocross racer at that time.
Oh.
And I hadn't yet got married, but the young lady that I was with, young Julie at the time, we became husband and wife not long after that. And as part of our getting married, I made a decision. I can still remember saying it to her. I'm getting out of racing. I've had enough of this. We're going to go and make a difference. We're going to go and do something really special with our lives. We didn't really clearly know what that was going to be, but somehow or another, I knew that the Great Barrier Reef and flying aeroplanes and entertaining people and showing people the beauty of the reef and making a difference on the planet in the future was something that was going to happen. From an early age, I had this bug that we were doing the wrong thing with the planet. We as a nation, we as a people were doing the wrong thing. But I was too young and too inexperienced to understand exactly what that was. But I, deep down, I knew that we had to make a difference, just like Greta does, just like so many young people today.
I think a lot of people feel that way. We're just not sure where to start. But you found an excellent starting point. You picked a specific place and a specific project to get underway.
Absolutely. And I was very, very fortunate, and luck shines. There's no doubt about that. But to take luck, you've got to be prepared to put in the effort. And Julie and I put in enormous effort for many, many years to get it to where it is today. We had no guarantee we would ever even be able to fly anybody to the island, let alone eventually own the lease of the island and become what we call ourselves as the custodians, the people who've got that opportunity to look after it. But I believed in myself, and I believed that nature looks after you if you do the right thing. And so we pushed on. I learned to fly. We bought our first airplane. We started flying to the nearest island because it was easy to get a permission to fly in there and land our float planes. We started to learn the aviation business, the tourism business, and the island business. And whilst looking at Lady Elliot, which we flew past every day for 10 years, and thinking, how are we going to get an opportunity to fix that little place and to have an opportunity to have a business there and entertain people, educate people, show people what they can do to make a difference. People said we were crazy, and people probably less now than in the old days, but in those early years, man, did I get told I was crazy. You can't do that.
I was just going to say, I think the craziest ideas sometimes end up being the most exciting and successful and wonderful results, right?
You're right, Mona. If you look at history, like that.
You had such intention with what you wanted to do, and I feel like your intention was manifested in making this a reality. So you said when you first started flying there, you asked the current custodian at the time if he would do a handshake agreement that you could take over the lease at a certain point, not knowing again if that would ever happen. But once you did, what did you start doing to reverse some of this damage to the island?
Yeah, well, he was from the old school, a wonderful old fellow, but from the old school where you ran noisy diesel generators and you just put in whatever happened with vegetation and so on, and don't worry about the environment. That's going to be there forever. Whereas I was this crazy young fellow that said we can do it differently. And it was a bit of a humour to him. What he said to me was, son, you got a sting in your tail. And I think that's his words for saying, you're driven. You're driven and you're going to do whatever it is that's driving you. You're going to make it happen. So we shook hands. It was literally a handshake arrangement. In 10 years' time, I'm going to buy this island off you because you're going to be 80 and I'm going to be 45 and that'll be about the right time. And you'll have taught me this and I'll have learnt enough to do it. And 10 years later, basically that's what happened. He laughed at me and said, you're crazy, son. You're never going to do these things. You know? You're never going to get rid of your diesel generators and you're never going to revegetate this the way it was 200 years ago.
You showed him. You showed him.
That was in about, if my timing's correct, 2005 or so, right, Peter? So
absolutely.
What did you undertake immediately? I seem to recall you started planting particular kinds of indigenous trees like casuarinas. What were some of those initial steps you took and what were some of the results?
I'm going to refer to a book that is deep in my heart, that's full of so many life's lessons, and that's The Lord of the Rings, written by Tolkien.
Uh-huh.
I've read that book so many times I can't count it. And there's a section in there when Sam Gamgee comes back to the Shire. He's got this little file of magic dirt that he's been given by the Lady of the Forest, and he says, what am I going to do with this? And she says to him, use your mind and do what you think's best for the forest. Put one piece of that dirt at the base of every tree around the Shire, because the Shire had been so badly damaged. And I used that philosophy. If I put all my focus in one area, then the other areas were getting ignored. The whole place needed action as quickly as possible. So we started on the forest. We started to learn how to work the forest with no real knowledge or experience. No one had really ever done. To my knowledge, no one has ever done what we had done. So we did the best we could, getting knowledge and ideas from others that we knew, because I'd worked within the marine parks and the national parks and had great friendships with people within the government departments and people that work that job. But we also had buildings that were in very, very bad state, really, you know, in some people's words were they should have been condemned. Mm-hmm. So we had to look after the guests. We had to look after the buildings they were within. We had to get the right number of staff and the right quality of staff. But we also had to stop using the diesel generators. That was my primary focus. And it was for a couple of reasons. Diesel was really noisy. And the diesel generator was noisy and off-putting in such a pristine environment, but it was also smelly. It was also a lot of greenhouse gas.
It's also expensive to boat in from the mainland, isn't it, to get your
Absolutely.
Fuel there?
And that's a key word, you know. That brought me to my 4E's philosophy, where we talk about if you want to look after the environment, there's a few things you have to do. One of them is you have to be economically sustainable. Two is you need to educate people effectively. And three is you need to be efficient. And efficiency means don't waste. And that word waste has so many connotations to it, whether it's wasting your time, your energy, your money, how you're managing the waste that we deal with in every day. So we just drilled down on all those things. And we shared those little pieces of dirt around that forest, the forest being the whole Lady Elliot place and enterprise, because no one was backing me financially at that time. We had lots of debt with the bank and lots of risk and lots of courage and lots of passion, but not much else, you know. And so we had to stretch every rubber band as hard as we could, you know. As I said, every rock had to be belted hard to get the blood out of it to try and make it work. So we needed the guests, because the guests brought the money that enabled us to do the extra. And the guests were the people that were falling in love with it and going away, and they were encouraging us, because the guests would come out there and go, wow, look at what you've done. So it made you feel, well, I must be doing the right thing. Maybe I'm not as crazy as all these other people tell me. Mm-hmm. And the more we succeeded, the more support we got. And that, to me, was just confirmation that we were doing something that needed to be done, and someone had to have the courage to do it.
And you were going about it intelligently too, I think. You knew and you had researched and realized that it all is connected. The marine wildlife that comes to the reef is connected to the birds and the trees and the guano. And so you went about planting things that would specifically bring the birds back, right? And then that would in turn affect the reef. And now you have all these manta rays. So can you talk a little bit more about what has happened since you began this rehabilitation process and some of the results now?
Yeah, absolutely, Catherine. You're exactly right. The connectivity is way deeper than any of us realize. You've probably heard the old saying that a cyclone happens in Africa and the leaves wobble in South America. And it's just so true, you know. The world is so interconnected. And
like butterfly effect or the guano effect, as the case may be.
And so we knew some things, and we were very fortunate because we have a host of visitors come out there, and the visitors were a fantastic source of knowledge, whether it was a scientist who had a scientific understanding or a farmer who was a third-generation farmer and spent all his life on the land learning about the connectivity of the land, or a fisherman that had been working the reef, catching fish all his life. And so I drew all that knowledge. I was so fortunate to have amazing knowledge. And I'm a good talker, but I'm also a pretty good listener, you might wonder, but I do, and I take it in.
We appreciate you for both.
So I had the best possible education, and that education is continuing now and ongoing. So we saw that as we revegetated it, we could see things improving on the terrestrial environment, on the land. There's no doubt the trees were better, the birds were better. We started to notice the corals and the water environment improving. And remembering that one of the first things we had happen was, with a lot of pushing, we managed to get the Marine Park Authority to declare the whole area around Lady Elliot Island, the whole region for several miles around it, a green zone, a marine national park, no take, no fishing, no spearing. All the planets aligned. We got that protection. At the same time, we were looking after it, and it was starting to recover, and we're getting more birds and more vegetation, and it started to recover. And it recovered and recovered and recovered, both on the land but in the water. And so the in the water stuff was one that maybe this will happen, but who knows for sure. No one really knew. There was no papers on it.
How long it could take too, you know. There's literally a trickle-down effect that could take years or decades as far as anyone knew at that point.
Absolutely, Eric. And so it was only about 5 years ago that we really said, hey, there's something seriously going on here. This is really happening in a cycle. And so some scientific researchers got behind us, because we're so fortunate. They come out there a lot, other different things. They said, Pete, you're right. And I said, so we drilled holes way down 5 meters. What's that, about 6 yards down into the base of the island to try and understand the water table, because we knew something was happening with the water table. A, we wanted to make sure we were doing no harm with the numbers of people that we had there and how we were managing our water, but B, try and understand it. So we could see that the water table was in really good condition, but where was the water going and what was happening? So Dr. Kathy Townsend and her team have now started a project called Leaf to Reef, and they're now doing a study of what happens from the leaf to where the water goes out to the reef. And it's mind-blowing. It's absolutely mind-blowing. It's exactly what we said. The birds go fishing, they catch little fish, they come back, they feed their babies, they poop, it lands on the island. And then, of course, the rain comes down and the vegetation and the bird poop and the dead birds, and that soaks down in, and then that slowly goes out to the coral. And traditional thinking has always said, nutrient, phosphorus and nitrogen will kill coral. And yes, it does. But it's a bit like chocolate. If you have too much of it, you're going to get sick.
Right.
And just the right amount, it's great. It's great for the reef. So in ideal concentrations, of which nature's balanced, and so Lady Elliot's back in balance and the corals are blooming. And of course, if they're blooming, then the fish life is blooming from the little ones up it goes, up to the apex. That's what's happening.
I think you've also alluded to this a couple of times, but one of the interesting parts for us, especially as travel writers, is just how important getting investment from your visitors and travelers has been to making Lady Elliot a success. And you talked about it so beautifully with us before, which is that it's not just about wowing visitors, you know, on their first trip to the island. Many of them come back. They bring their children back. The children come back and volunteer with you. You provide these opportunities for people to make the place their own. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that and why you think it's important.
You're exactly right. That is so critical that we get buy-in from our guests for so many reasons. And going back to my 4 E's, economics is important. If we aren't making money, if I haven't got the money to spend, I can't do the good work that needs to be done. So capitalism is not a bad thing. Profits are not bad things as long as what we do with the profits is smart, is sensible. So guests coming out bring so many positives to us. A, they bring that financial bonus, but B, they bring their energy, their enthusiasm, their knowledge. They teach us things. They go away enthused. They contact us later and they give us ideas, but then they start to fall in love with the place. And then you have what you touched on is those 2 and 3 generations of visits, as in grandpa and grandma, you've got mum and dad and you've got the kids, and we don't have internet or very difficult internet. So the kids aren't doing this. So they're sitting there talking to mum and dad.
You can't see Peter right now, but he's twiddling on a fake phone, on a pantomime phone. The children have to sit and talk to the old people. How novel.
They might learn something.
My word. And you know what? The old people learn from the young people too. And that's what I love, because they all interact. And that's what makes a community. And that's what brings our ethics and our values out, is that ability to communicate. And Lady Elliot becomes a vehicle of communication between the families, between nature, between the environment, between other families. They fall in love with the place. And I mean, a lady sent me an email last night asking me a great question. She said, oh, by the way, Pete, it's my 14th visit. And it's like, wow, you know, so we've got people that are coming there as if it's their home, away from home, I guess you could say. So that support of each other is really important to the future of the island, but it's also important, and there's a lesson in this. I see Lady Elliot as a small example, and it's little and it's round, just like our big round globe, our big round planet. It's a great example of what we should be doing on a bigger scale on the planet. We really should be looking after each other, working as a community, caring for each other, accepting that we have differences of opinion, accepting that my idea is not always the right one. It can be the young kids today and it can be the old guys tomorrow. Or, you know, it can be the scientist can be right this time, could be the farmer next time, caring for each other and looking after the environment and managing our waste, managing our economics, being efficient, educating each other. I think they are really key lessons that Lady Elliot sends out for the rest of the planet.
Absolutely. And I don't know, just talking to you gets me so inspired for so many reasons. But I also would love for you to talk a little bit about some of the efforts that you've made to minimize the footprint of the lodge. I know you've done some really cool things with repurposing materials. And I mean, you're just so low footprint.
Have you got all day? So we're now running basically 100% on solar. We got more solar than we can ever use. It's amazing. And of course, with that, we make our water. So we desalinate our water. And as you know, water is a critical issue on this planet. It's only going to get worse. And here we are making it basically for free from the sun. So that's pretty cool. I just get such a kick out of that.
A lot of people around the world, as we'll talk about on another episode in this season, can really benefit from such technology as well. So that's incredible.
So yeah, we're making our power from the sun, gone from about $250,000 a year to where it's costing me $20,000 a year on fuel or less.
Wow.
And that's just our... It's it's just a radical saving. And so we took the saving and invested into other things. And of course, that is our desalination. So then we looked at how can we make our desal plant more and more efficient so it can make all our water when the sun's out. We didn't want to be making water when the batteries were running because that's false economy. So efficiency came through time and effort, making mistakes. And so the lessons learned there can be used elsewhere. Then we get to our wastewater, because here we are in a World Heritage listed national park. We try to minimize our footprint, yet we're producing about 30,000 litres a day of wastewater. And of course, that doesn't go with a pristine marine environment. So we had a system, a wastewater system that was there, but it was very poor quality, what they call C standard. So we wanted an A plus standard. And of course, they were talking $1 million and we didn't have $1 million. So how are we going to make this work? There's no such thing as can't. We'll find a way. We ended up building an A standard for about $250,000 and got the right people and the right brains to put together. And we experimented and refined it and refined it. And we got it to A plus standard, which is UV sterilization using the best form of UV on the planet, the sun, because the sun can UV sterilize. So it's efficient. It's utilizing this and the sun and all of our skills there.
And you don't use any plastic on the island. And I think you also had told us even the glass gets broken down by some kind of fancy machine so that you can turn it into sand essentially and transport it off the island.
Yeah, so we were sending our glass bottles back off. Remember, we only run 4 barges a year. So we oppressed it back to sand basically. Mm-hmm. And we could put it on the beach, but we won't, because Lady Elliot is a coral cay, remember. It's not a mineral sand island, it's organic. Mm-hmm. So that glass sand or that mineral sand that the glass has come from is not compatible. So we send it back to the mainland and it gets recycled. And then, of course, you come back to our buildings. When we took over, the buildings were in abominable shape. You heard me say it was almost condemnable. They were steel-framed, flat-roofed. They were secondhand when they went out there in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. And here they were 20 years later, you know, just in poor condition. And how can we fix them? So we've just used the embedded energy that are in those older buildings, and we found ways to improve them and bring them up to the point where people now say to me, and even only last Saturday I had a plumber out there helping me. He said, gee, these are lovely new buildings. How long have they been here? I said, well,
well, if you just take care of things, right, and give them purpose, suddenly they look young again, like people, I suppose.
Well, there's only so much we can do there, mate. I've got a few of those. And then, of course, we had these tents, and they were not expensive tents. They were just on a simple piece of timber floor, and then they were a little canvas top and a bit more canvas over the top of that. And they were really cheap, and they'd been there since forever when we took over, and they were in pretty poor condition. So we found a beautiful, what they call the eco tent, that's made here in Australia, and we wanted to replace the old ones. So, of course, we got some support to get those new tents in, and people kept saying to me, oh, so you're just going to dump the old tents? I said, no way. They thought, oh, Pete's lost his mind again. What are we up to this? I said, we're going to reuse, we're going to repurpose those old tents. Really? Yeah. So we got the first 4. We put them on a lovely aluminium frame. So we repurposed their whole timber base, the whole top. Then we put a set of solar panels over the top of that, and they became our first 4 tents for our volunteers. We now call it the Volunteer Hub, repurposed. People go on, they look at it and they go, what's that? Oh, that's the old tent. We just rejuvenated them. We just repurposed them. So then people feel really chuffed. Oh, yeah, this makes sense. And so then it gets them thinking what they can do back at home.
One of the things you said in a previous conversation that really stuck with me is it wasn't one thing that got the island to this place. It was a million little things, a million actions. And so it's going to take a million band-aids to heal these million cuts, but you've done so many things toward that effort. And I know you've gotten government support eventually because the government of Australia has seen all these huge strides you've made. So they've stepped in and supported as well. But I'm curious what you feel like are some of the sort of lessons that other people could take from this in other places in the world and emulate or be inspired by this model that you've created.
Yeah, Catherine, you're right. I talk about the death of 1,000 cuts or the death of 1,000,000 cuts, and Lady Elliot suffered that, but so too has our planet, hasn't it? There hasn't been one thing that's put us where we sit today. So it's not reasonable to think it's going to be one thing that's going to fix it. It's going to be 1,000,000 band-aids. It's going to be 1,000,000 actions. It's going to overcome those 1,000,000 mistakes or things that we did that at the time, because there's very few of those things that were done deliberately by anybody. No one thought when they were doing whatever it was that they're doing was going to make it bad for our children or our grandchildren, or they wouldn't have done it. And humans are not stupid, but we did what we did at the time with the knowledge that we had. But today we're blessed because we've got better knowledge. We've got better ability better understanding. So we can now make those million band-aids. We can make those actions to recover and repair it. And so what I think is, yeah, use the word emulate, use the word copy, use the word inspiration. I don't mind, because we're not too proud as to emulate, copy, or be inspired by others. So if we can give someone some inspiration or something to follow in their world, and I think that's really important. Lady Elliot is a unique destination, but so too is Hamilton Island, further up on the Great Barrier Reef. So too is the Bahamas, a unique destination. So too is Indonesia, and so too is the Arabian continent, you know, that top end of Africa. All unique destinations, all requiring unique attention and unique action. And so the people that are there, and I think a lady who I just adore is Jane Goodall. She talks about the four reasons for hope. There's now five, but of those four, without going into them all, one of them is the brilliance of the human mind. We humans have a brilliant mind. The other one is the indomitable human spirit. So we're all blessed with a brilliant mind. We all got this amazing spirit and the brilliance of youth. You know, there's three of them. I'll let you guess the next two. So we've all got this
wisdom
mind.
Of age is one of them for all our
sakes. Yeah, we'll give you that one. So wherever we live on the planet, we should be looking at our challenges, at the things that have happened around us. What's the positives? What's the negatives? How can I make a difference? How can I input in some way? How can I add one of those little band-aids to that little cut that happened 5, 10, 20, 50 years ago? And it doesn't matter who you are, doesn't matter where you are within this beautiful planet that we live in, this beautiful blue planet, the only one we know that's got a lovely atmosphere of oxygen and beautiful water, that has lovely green trees and magnificent biodiversity. It's up to us, with this brilliant mind, to find a way to improve it. We know the answer. We know how to fix it. We're at this precipice right now where we now know what the problem is and we know how to fix it. We just have to have the will and the desire and the energy to get out there and do it. And I'm blessed because my tiny little place, it's easy for Pete to just grab a hold and say, no, we're not doing that. We're doing it like this because that's what we need to do. It's not so easy for a premier or a prime minister or a president of a nation to do that. But leaders are really followers. They follow public opinion. And if we're pushing up, they're going to copy us. And we're seeing that now with electric vehicles. Norway's at 50% car sales electric now. Amazing.
Yeah. Well, it's nice that they got there with oil wealth. But I'll also say, you know, Peter, what you said that struck home is that you can't do it yourself. You have to find like-minded partners with the will, the drive, the energy, the funding to do so. And hearing you speak with such passion has only made me redouble my own desires to get down to Lady Elliot Island, because I still haven't been and I am anxious to go diving with those manta rays as soon as we're able to travel again.
Absolutely. Something to look forward to. And I can't wait to take you snorkeling.
That sounds incredible. Well, yeah. I need to come. I'm going to come bring my baby. She's going to plant a tree. I want to get over there and get involved in all of your exciting activities.
Thanks again for your time today.
Thank you. And you're already playing your part because you're helping me to get the story out that people can and will make a difference with the future. So thank you, Catherine. I can't wait to see you and your beautiful little baby. And Eric, we're going snorkeling with mantas. See you soon, mate. Thanks.
We're in.
I've been missing Australia since my last trip there at the end of 2019. But talking to Peter makes it all the more poignant. I cannot wait to dive out at Lady Elliot Island next time I'm down under.
Me too. It sounds like paradise. And he's just so inspiring, I feel all fired up. I'd love to return to Akagera in a few years too and see how much more progress is made there. Both these stories, along with those of places like Mozambique's Gorongosa National Park and the clearing of landmines in Cambodia, give me great hope for what we can achieve when conservation is our guiding principle.
For more information on Akagera National Park and Lady Elliot Island, check out our post on this episode at ConsciousTravelerPod.com and follow us on Instagram at ConsciousTravelerPod.
We'd like to give special thanks to Matthew Carpenter, who composed the music you heard in this episode.